So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm senior editor Devendra Hardawar.
I'm reviews editor Sherlyn Lowe.
And today, it's all about Samsung. So much Samsung. Five different devices from Samsung. So you're going to get tired of hearing us saying Samsung.
Samsung.
Samsung. All day. All day. This is going to be a jam-packed episode because of Samsung's Galaxy Unpacked event. Mm-hmm. That's the name of it, right?
Yeah.
We were trying to come up with a better name for that, but it is a deluge of tons and tons of products. Sherlyn's going to be talking about her Pixel 4a review, which sounds like the perfect $350 phone. We've got a couple other things to dive into. A little bit of Microsoft and TikTok and whatever is happening there. And actually, that's related to the Trump administration and trying to, I don't know, control more Chinese companies. There's an iMac refresh to talk about. Disney's putting Mulan in Disney Plus. It has been a jam-packed week. I'm tired. I'm so tired. It's Thursday morning. And yeah, I feel for you, Sherlyn. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes because that's super helpful. And if you'd like to watch us record this thing live, join us Thursdays around 10 a.m. on the Engadget YouTube channel. We'll put up posts about that too, but that's a chance for you to join in and, you know, talk with us as we're discussing these episodes, see some behind the scenes action. We're looking forward to having a lot of back and forth with people. So Samsung Unpacked 2020, Sherlyn, what, first of all, let's talk on a broader level. What was this event like for you just to prepare for and just experience? Because normally it's you and Chris Velasco, you know, hopping in a plane, either flying somewhere or going to the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, which, I already miss living in New York, but that place was so close to me. And I still have not had to attend a tech event there. So annoying. The one time I live next to a good tech venue. But how was the event overall for you?
I mean, it was nice to be able to do it from home. I didn't want to, usually an event like this requires, if we're flying to a different city for this, we would get up in whatever time zone, get ready and go wait in line for an hour and a half, and then be allowed into the venue and then wait another hour for the event to start. So we typically, let's say the event starts at 10 a.m. we're both up at like 6, but the around 6 or 7 we have to get up and then spend 3 hours waiting in line or waiting around for the show to start. So this time around it was really nice to do it from home. I don't know if moving forward that'll be a preferred option, but you know, I was also able to just live stream. So we didn't talk a lot during the Samsung event itself, but we had a post show on the Engadget YouTube channel. You can go watch that. It's still there if you want to. And yeah, it's much better than having to live blog, which if you've ever seen me at a show, you probably think I'm a monster because I don't talk to people. I'm just like, don't talk to me. I am typing down everything that's being said on stage.
Let's just take a step back here too, because what a live blog. Listen, if you're an Engadget reader or a listener, you probably have seen us be doing, you know, live blogs for decades, like, or at least the past 15 years. How long has Engadget? It's been around so long.
Yeah.
But live blogging has been like, it was the de facto way to cover a live event because you're just basically transcribing what people are saying, taking photos real quick. I think we're beginning to feel that maybe the live blog is a little outdated because everybody's streaming their own events. So why would a reader go to us watching, you know, static photos and everything? So we're doing these commentaries over their live streams, which I think is more modern, a little more accessible for a lot of people.
And the value that we can, provide there, it's tough because you have to manage, letting Samsung speak and also adding your own context and opinion in the moment. And for me, I think the value is because I've been briefed before Samsung's event. I know typically more than the average viewer. And Samsung doesn't go into all the details during a stream either. It's going to tell you a very powerful processor, but it's not going to tell you the model during its live stream.
Right.
That's where I can jump in and quickly say that's the Snapdragon 865 Plus, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, no, I mean, overall, the event was good. I mean, we had the support of our video team as well, who, seriously, kudos to them. Power outage and still trooping on. So...
And this wasn't entirely a virtual event too, right? Because I know Chris also went in and took a meeting and got to see some phones in person. So
yeah, so we had we were able to get a preview of some of the devices beforehand. We had everything ready to go at 10 a.m. the start of the announcement, and we had hands-ons with the Note 20 and the Note 20 Ultra. Well, not really hands-ons. I mean, it was a very controlled environment, so we had video content.
Unlike other events, right? It's not just us kind of seeing stuff virtually, you can get your hand on. You can actually feel it.
Yeah, Samsung had to go to great lengths to kind of plan it out for us to try these events out beforehand.
And
try
doing it securely out. And everything.
Yeah, with all the safety procedures they needed to. And they were. I think they did it well. I mean, they did ask for feedback ahead of time, and I was like, do it this way.
Everyone is just making it up as they go along. Let's talk about these devices though, because weirdly, I feel like the one that is most exciting is the one we didn't actually get to see ahead of time, because I don't even know how real it is at this point, and that is the Galaxy Z Fold 2, the third folding phone from Samsung, the second
technically the third
fold model. It's also very confusing, right? Because the first fold was essentially a prototype. That was a disaster of a launch. It was so expensive, fell apart so quickly. You can go back and read up all on that stuff. But the Galaxy Z Flip felt like more of a more polished product. Seems like they learned a lot from their mistakes. And the Z Fold 2 seems like, okay, a lot of what they learned from the Galaxy Z Flip is going into this phone. What are your thoughts, Shalyn? Because you've reviewed some of these and have explored them, at least.
I'm super hyped for these, right? To your point, I mean, one of the things that is going to be a theme during this episode is Samsung's naming standards are just really confusing. This is the Z Fold 2. Now, the original Fold was just a Galaxy Fold. Somewhere they decided to add the Z and call the Z Flip the Z Flip. And now it's the Z Fold 2. So that's just kind of a mishmash of everything.
And also it's like they don't have spaces in their names anymore. So it's like Galaxy Z Fold 2. Fold 2. That's one word.
Folding to what? Anyway.
I don't know.
Naming aside, this is by all appearances a vast improvement over the original Fold. Again, based on just what we've seen so far, it's got a much bigger 6.2-inch screen on the outside when the Fold is folded, when the Z Fold 2 is folded upon itself. When you open up the screen, you've got more of a 7.6 or 7.8-inch display. That's a similar size, I think, to the original Fold, which was coming in at about 8 inches. And it's got a nice kind of punch hole camera in the opened up screen, rather than this kind of like notch boat thing that was in the original Fold. So the style of it, the design looks more refined than before. They're also saying they're using this UTG, this ultra thin glass that they had used on the Z Flip, which was important because it made the Z Flip feel a lot smoother on the surface of the screen than the Fold, which felt kind of plasticky. And in fact, back then, I think they were using plastic too, because glass doesn't fold. And Samsung had to invent this whole new thing, they say, which is really glass, but it's ultra thin. It's thinner than glass. A human hair.
Which doesn't sound... And that's mainly for the feel of it, because the plastic feel of the Galaxy Fold screen was not great for swiping.
You could
and
feel components through the screen as you're scrolling. Yeah, you could feel like little mechanism things under the screen. Yes.
That's fun. But also a thin layer of glass, I don't think really adds much protection, right? How did you feel about the Z Flip?
I liked the Z Flip. The Z Flip actually felt sturdy. It felt like Samsung had learned a lot of lessons from what Chris Velasco called a very public experiment, right? It was basically a public experiment.
The worst sorts of experiments,
But sad to the people who spent thousands of dollars buying the public experiment. But anyway, so Samsung learned a lot of lessons, implemented it with the Z Flip, where they basically, you know, had to make sure the screen was tucked under all the bezel bits that cover the screen. They made improvements to the hinge, which we're going to get to in a little bit, but that prevents dust from getting in and breaking the hinge, which means you then get stuck with a half open or a closed device.
It should, but yeah.
So this these improvements were made to the Z Flip that I just loved it. I also just love mm-hmm. the old school nostalgia value to it of having that very Motorola Razr-like feel of flipping over and open
sure,
a phone.
Sure, sure. It was poor Motorola and their Razr reboot. Like, that's, oh man, Samsung just did it better, unfortunately.
Did it much better. You know what?
Yeah.
Good on Samsung. Good for you, Samsung. Like, I mean, sad that you're crushing your competition like this, but good for you for learning from all these mistakes.
And here's the thing. Like, it sounds like I typically rag on Samsung. What I do is I rag on first generation products from everybody. Yep. But I think Samsung, compared to a lot of other companies, Samsung needs like two or three generations to really get a handle of its products, right? I think the Galaxy phones, like the original mm-hmm. Galaxy phones, it wasn't until the S3 where things were really good and you're like, oh, this is an iPhone competitor.
The S5 was like, ooh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Apple still takes like at least one generation to get things right. But I think by the second gen, you know, Apple tends to speed up, and they also don't prototype in public, which seems bad. But let's talk more about these changes for the Z Fold 2. And they're pretty much all from the Z Flip, because the hinge thing, one thing we learned from the Galaxy Fold is that you have a screen that folds. When you have it open a little, that means there's a gap. That means there's stuff that can get in, dust can get in. For reviewers, they saw that quickly could destroy the hinge of the original Fold. So they added this like vacuum cleaner-esque brush to the Z Flip to keep dust out. They say for the Z Fold 2, it's a little smaller and thinner, but it's the same basic concept that it blocks dust, but it also like will self-clean the phone too, or self-clean the hinge. Here's the thing. I don't know how much we can trust Samsung about this, because iFixit tore apart the Z Flip. And the first thing they saw was like, that's a ton of crap in the hinge.
In the brush, yeah.
Yeah, that the brush didn't block or clean out. So I don't think it's foolproof.
I don't think it's foolproof. I think maybe the brush is in there just to provide some sort of
something. Yeah.
Ease of movement in the hinge when there is dust in there. I don't know. But the idea is that, also to your point, right? Like, when dust or grit gets in the hinge mechanism, then when you open your screen, you're going to hear something like, you know what I mean? Ooh. Like, there's pieces in there. They're going to like grind on each other and on the parts of the phone. You don't want that to happen. So the guard kind of makes that a little bit easier. I'm not entirely sure it's going to work, obviously. I've not touched the Z Fold 2. And but the Z Flip did feel nice. And I had very limited time with it. But during that limited time, and I know people who are still using the Z Flip 2 today, like almost, what is it, like
really?
6 months
people
now?
People who aren't like tech reviewers?
No,
or
they are tech reviewers,
people?
But they've been using it daily.
I find me a normal person with one
of
these
there's
phones.
No, there is none. There is none, because
that
it's way too expensive. And we'll get to that. But the brush seems to work in daily life on the Z Flip. Maybe that's just an easier device because it's smaller too, right? There are challenges with a bigger screen and a bigger hinge. But the other thing that I am very interested in about the Z Fold 2, God, I'm so confused with the names. The Z Fold 2 is that screen is not just bigger, the one that you open up, the bigger 8-inch screen. It's also 120Hz, I believe, in AMOLED, which
nice.
Is crazy. They just debuted that on the Note 20 Ultra, which we'll also get to in a bit, but not on the Note 20, which is blasphemy. But yeah, 120Hz screen on the Galaxy Z Fold 2.
And that
I'm
seems
impressed.
Like the thing, the hot thing we'll be seeing in more phones is faster refresh rates going beyond 60Hz. That really does make a difference. Like, if you're used to using any device, really, a normal screen or your smartphone, we're all used to 60Hz. Once you see anything beyond that, it is like butter.
Yeah.
It is kind of amazing. So that's a good thing.
Yeah,
at least.
I agree.
Yeah, and the outside screen is a little bigger too, right? It's not just like a little sliver.
Oh,
it's a nice
big screen.
No,
now it's the whole front. Yeah, it's finally looking like it's going to be usable, which is great. And the design looks refined to the point where if it's folded in half and you hold it like it's a regular candy bar phone, I guess, it doesn't look like it's a chunky, you know, like couple of candy bars stuck together. It's kind of a situation.
Okay. It's going to be an interesting year for dual screen phones, because the Surface Duo is still on track to come this year. And that is Microsoft's like really cool courier style booklet. So, I'm looking forward to this competition. I'm not looking forward to the price for the Z Fold 2.
No one is. I will say that we don't know a lot about the Z Fold 2 just yet, right? All we know is the new screen sizes, the 120Hz refresh rate, the new color, and whatever. Samsung teased that on September 1st, there will be more news to share about the Z Fold 2. So obviously, Engadget will have the news for you too, so come back and check it out. But things, details like the price haven't been shared. But we can make educated guesses.
Sure. All right? The Fold was expensive. The original
Fold was somewhere around $2,400, $2,300, $2,400. Which, ouch. Then the Z Flip was around more like $1,800, $1,600.
An affordable $1,800 phone.
Still, sure. For some people, a month rent, right? A month's rent.
If you're lucky,
I know. I would expect the Z Fold 2 to be north of $2,500 just because it's nicer, but... Samsung.
I feel realistically they need to stick between $2,000 and $2,500. Like, we cannot keep pushing
on the lower end,
this boundary. It is insane. I don't recommend $2,000 computers to people, let alone a $2,000
laptop.
Phone. So,
oh my gosh. A laptop doesn't even cost that much.
My favorite laptop's easily under between $1,200 and $1,500 bucks, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So I want to say... Yeah. Maybe Samsung's going to hear a lot of the feedback because there's been a lot of criticism online, but maybe Samsung's going to hear some of this and be like, okay, we're going to make it cheaper. Here it is at $1,999. And that's still very expensive, but I guess.
That's old Samsung that used to like really, you know, push the boundaries on margin and everything. Mm-hmm. I don't think new high-tech Samsung that's actually at the top of the field will do that. They're just gonna be like, deal with it. You want this cool phone? Give me $2,500. Give me whatever I say.
And to your point about early generation devices, right? The original Fold, I, like you, you know, always caution against using first gen devices. The Galaxy Z Fold 2 technically is a third gen device at this point and looks really nice. But if you hold out one more year, you're going to get a much better device anyway. So you might as well
just
wait.
Just hold out.
Save
okay,
that
so
money.
What about the phones people can actually get, which are also still pretty expensive,
Good
but
Lord.
I think maybe more reasonable. The Note 20, the Note 20s, two of them.
There are two Note 20s. Let's break them down. Okay, we've got the Note 20 and the Note 20 Ultra. The Note 20 Ultra is the big boy. Okay, it's got a 6.9-inch screen, 120Hz refresh rate, powered by the Snapdragon 865 Plus. It's got the, you know, quad sensor array, you know, quad cameras or something like that, similar to the S20 Ultra, where there is a space zoom feature. And then you've got the S Pen, right, which has been improved to have a latency of 9 milliseconds. And together with the 120Hz refresh rate, that makes for like. Makes your writing just feel like it's flying, right? When you're writing on the screen, it feels like there's almost literally no delay, which for me as an S Pen user in the past, I've never really even had a problem with the older latency rate. So this is going to be much better.
It's one of those hidden benefits of faster response rates that we keep saying, like, you have to see these things to really understand how it makes a phone screen better. But I can understand, like, with a stylus, like, that is all about the instance of detecting when you're hitting the screen and how you're moving the actual pen. I think Apple did a good job with the iPad Pro because the iPad Pros also had higher refresh rate screens, and combined with the Pencil, they did a good job of interacting with that. My favorite, the thing I think feels the best though, is the Surface stuff, because they put a lot of work into the actual Surface Pen and the tips and the tips, like making the tips feel like they're pens, pen on paper, is the experience I want. Yeah.
We talked about this when we were preparing for the show today, and I just feel like I've tried all three styli.
Sure.
Well, no, actually not so much time with the Pencil, which I hear is a very good stylus, but I have spent time with the S Pen, which is and the S Pen for tablets, which is a bit bigger, more like a real pen, more like the Surface Pen, and also the Surface Pen. And I always feel like the Surface Pen has this kind of a draggy sense to it. Maybe it's because of the screen that I'm using it on.
They added some, like, that's the thing. They added resistance to that screen so that it's not just super smooth and loopy, because when you write on paper, like, that to me, that's the experience they're trying to get, is like, okay, if I'm jotting down notes, you feel the friction of your pen on paper. I don't want to just feel zipping through glass, you know.
And that's fine. I mean, everyone has their preferences. I will say I like the S Pen experience. It's been very smooth. It's been very responsive. What I want Samsung to work on now is fix your palm rejection. Oh my gosh. That
really
needs work.
It's only been nearly 10 years since they've been making these smartphones. They still haven't fixed that with, like, the Note series. Because, like, the whole point of the Note is that you're holding it. It's a big phone, holding it in your hand while you're jotting down notes. It's still having palm issues.
Well, it's I'm shouting out more to the my last experience with the S Pen, which was the Galaxy Tab S6 Lite. Now that device, sure. The palm rejection needed work. I don't generally have palm rejection issues on a note because I'm not like this is the note. I'm not putting my palm down on a note while I'm drawing with the S Pen. So actually, palm rejection might not be as important on a phone, but on a tablet like the Tab S6 and the Tab S7 and S7 Plus that we're going to talk about later, palm rejection is very important. That's one thing where Samsung software falls short, but they introduced some new software, okay, with the new S Pen.
A whole bunch of stuff.
Oh my gosh!
So, what about the Note 20s? We got 5G. Is that
we've got
exciting?
5G across the line?
Is that standard, or do you have to like go for the
standard,
5G option?
Okay. It's standard across both devices this time around. And I mean, good on if you're a person that's looking to buy one of the Note 20s this year, you're likely going to expect 5G because the Note line is for power users, early adopters. Now, it is a travesty, though, that Samsung is selling the Note 20, the smaller version, for $999 starting price, and it's a plastic back. Like, have a video up. Chris Velasco did a very good editorial take on that, saying that this is just, it's a questionable
How
decision.
Dare you?
How could you? It's a $1,000 phone with a plastic back, a 60Hz screen, because the 120Hz screen is only on the larger Note Ultra, the Note 20 Ultra. The smaller one gets a 60Hz screen, plastic back, and some other important differences. I was reading the comments on that video that we put out on this topic yesterday, and everyone seemed to agree. All the Note users demand more from their phones.
It's supposed to be the premium above the standard Galaxy line. So that is wild to me. Let's just take a rewind to 5G, by the way. You're saying 5G across the line. What does that mean for consumers? That means for the few people who have 5G access, they can walk down like a city block and have very fast internet. But if they turn left or turn right, they're going to start to have trouble, right? Our 5G coverage is still bad.
I mean, there are people who were asking me on Twitter about the Pixel 4a and 5G and why it doesn't have 5G. And there are people for whom 5G is important because either they're going to hold on to their phones for the next 2 or 3 years and they want to be able to use it when the networks come on. Or they just really are in a city already having good 5G coverage. Good for you, okay? But it depends, to Devendra's point, right? If your experience is going to be good or bad, depends on the type of 5G that you're experiencing. So T-Mobile did announce, I think this week, that it's launching, it's got its first standalone 5G network all online. But bear in mind that T-Mobile largely uses sub-6, which is just a step above 4G LTE. It's not that much better. It's 25% faster speeds. Millimeter wave 5G, which is where it's at, and you'll hear this called ultra-wideband on some carriers, is the one where you're going to see vast improvements. But to Devendra's point, it's hard to maintain a signal to
you need line of sight.
And a lot of the technologies that we were promised that would help manage this connection, like beamforming and beam tracking, aren't actually on devices just yet. So it does seem like 5G.
Let me just explain line of sight. Line of sight literally means you need to be able to see a cell tower to get a signal. So if you have one of these 5G phones, hey, sure, maybe go to a street corner, you know, wink at your 5G tower, get some fast speeds. You go back home, you go anywhere else.
Yeah.
You're out of that range.
Yeah.
You're back to 4G. Basically,
coverage is very, very finicky on millimeter wave 5G, but I feel like 5G is the least trouble, like the least worrying, at least of my concerns when it comes to the Note 20s.
Do you think it's a feature that should be in these phones? I guess for the premium ones, but for a mid-range, for a $700 or $800 phone, should it even be there at this point?
For me, no. For me, for a phone that I'm not going to pay a lot of money for, like for the 4A, I don't need 5G, okay?
Right.
But for people who are buying the Note, who want that high-end experience, why not? Like,
why not means, like, that's a battery. Like, that radio is stronger, right? It's more powerful. Like, who knows what the battery hit is going to be?
It will take a hit on the battery, and, you know, I guess, like, and Samsung also put in bigger batteries on these Notes. But I kind of, I know 5G is problematic, but there's so much to talk about on the Note 20.
There's so much to talk about. We'll have to do a 5G episode, but I do think...
we already did a 5G episode.
No, like another one. You have to keep doing it now the decision is, like, these phones are coming, but is your decision between, do you want to be prepared for 5G or do you want better battery life by sticking with 4G, which is still fast for you? So anyway, anything else about what is the Note 20 Ultra? How is it different? Because that is a nearly 7-inch screen. That's insane.
Yeah, it's crazy. So I didn't like the S20 Ultra because it was a huge phone. It just feels, yeah. It's so heavy. It's hard to use.
It's a 7-inch screen. That's a tablet. That this used to be Android tablets.
The Note 20 Ultra is a 6.9-inch screen. And they even threw out the word phablet during the keynote. It's 120Hz display. It'll be nice to play games on. And to that point, sure. Samsung, gosh, they pulled up Phil Spencer. Head of Xbox to talk about Xbox Game Pass, which is one of the, I mean, during the live stream when that happened, me and Chris Velasco on our live stream went, Phil Spencer is here?
Well, also Game Pass and xCloud, the main thing. And xCloud is the like streaming game service that's going to be launching later this year for Game Pass subscribers.
Yes. And so if you pre-order, if you pre-order the Note 20 Ultra with the bundle, you're going to get 3 months free of xCloud when it's live. You're going to be one of first people to be able to try that out. Now,
it's like $45 value. Yeah.
Yeah. I was very interested to see Microsoft collaborate so tightly with Samsung here, because the other thing about the Note line is its multitasking productivity prowess. And Microsoft has worked with Samsung to get good integration with Office tools like Word, PowerPoint, and Excel on these phones through Dex, and we'll get to Dex later on. But
there's so much to talk about. Curse you, Samsung.
A lot to talk about. Oh, one episode. This episode's gonna be long, y'all. So if you want to come back, take a break, come back and listen. That's fine. But the Microsoft collaboration, I'll get to a bit deeper when I talk about the tablet, but it's very intriguing to me that Microsoft chose to team up with Samsung and not with Google to kind of make Android work better as a multitasking OS. But
I feel like this could be this could be Microsoft's first step. But yeah, what is next? What's the next gadget?
I mean, if we talk about, it's a clean seg right into the Tab S7 and the S7 Plus. I already have a hands-on with it. I can tell you, I've touched this thing. It's beautiful. Holy crap. I mean, in my article, I called it the Rolls Royce of Android tablets.
I mean, it's the only, which is a low bar,
right?
Left.
It's a very
it's
low
the
bar.
Only one left.
No, there's still Huawei making some nice Mate pads.
Can I buy that in the US?
That are not available in the US. No. Yeah. So in the US, it's your best premium Android, because Google stopped making tablets anyway. It feels really good. That screen on the S7 Plus, which is the unit that I receive, is a 12.4-inch 120Hz Super AMOLED. So this thing looks beautiful. I have been using it to draw. I've been watching some things on it, some videos on it. It's gorgeous. That wallpaper that Samsung very cleverly put in there just pops right off the screen. It also comes with a improved keyboard case. I have had major issues with Samsung's tablet keyboard cases for a while, mostly because they're just sometimes flimsy, but very crammed, not very usable. You also have, with the new Tab S7s, you've got larger screens, right? There are two models. The S7 is an 11-inch LCD, though. So that's sad.
Wait, what?
I know.
Haven't all the tabs up until now been AMOLED?
No,
isn't that the whole point?
The light that was just released earlier this year was not. But the more premium ones have always been Super AMOLED.
This is weird. So this is the second like premium feature Samsung kind of stepped back from in its premium lines.
It's very strange, right?
That is weird.
It's a tale of two tablets. It's a tale
of
two phones.
I still have a Galaxy Tab S2 sitting around that I had reviewed back in the day. But when they launched those things, they had gorgeous AMOLED screens. Like compared to the iPad, those screens were so bright and beautiful.
Yes, and they're still
and they still
gorgeous.
Hold up today. Yeah. So very weird to see Samsung going back there.
But anyhow, back to the point about the keyboard covers, right? With the older Samsung tablets in recent years tend to be 10-inch tablets, 10.5-inch. Now we've got an 11-inch on the S7, a 12.4-inch on the S7 Plus, and correspondingly, these keyboard cases are larger, which means more room for actual space, like wall-spaced keys at a good layout. So the
do they actually feel good to type on?
Oh my lord! So I have it here with me, and I will be showing this on the live stream. But I also do want to do a little bit of sound effect on the on the podcast. I'm gonna do this. I have the keyboard here.
Feedback sounds.
The keyboard.
This
feedback
is a very surface looking. Cover and keyboard.
It's a very surface looking the keys here, they I mean, I was surprised. They were very, they had a lot of travel. There's a lot of feedback. It's clickier than I'm used to.
And it's clickier, and I can see actual depth, and keyboard ASMR is a thing that doesn't exist yet, but as I'm thinking about it, I would probably really enjoy it. That's how I judge my keyboards.
this keyboard feels really good. I can tell you this. Okay. The typing on it was really nice. The trackpad is a little wider than before because of the added real estate, but it still feels like a trackpad on a keyboard case. Mm-hmm. It's not one that you like, it's not comparable to something on a laptop where sometimes it's glass covered and it feels so much smoother and better, but it works. So now that Samsung feels like it's really improved with the keyboard cover, my main issue, and I've had this issue with Samsung's tablets that are trying to be 2-in-1s in the past, Dex mode. Woo! I get it. You're trying.
Sexy, not so sexy. I don't know. That's my headline.
That's not bad. That's really good, Devendra.
I've been arguing to kill Dex for a while because it's not great. Yeah.
Too. My main, and you know what? Kudos on Samsung to Samsung for trying to iterate over and over again. Sure. But it still needs a lot of work, right?
One
of
the new things. What is Dex mode at a broad level?
On a broad level, Dex mode is this desktop interface, this desktop UI that runs on top of Android. So when you activate it, in the past you had to activate it yourself. When you activate it brings up, instead of like a home screen with all your app icons littered all over the page with your clock widget at the top, it looks more like a Windows desktop where you have app icons lined up on the left, sort of an app launcher at the bottom left, and then a taskbar and all of that stuff. And then you can run, apps in floating windows on this mode. You can layer the windows.
We've recreated the 20-year-old desktop OS paradigm.
I mean, yeah. And this has, and this has been on Dex for years, right? A couple years at the very least. And it's still largely the same. But Dex this time around got one of a few updates, which is wireless sync to a Samsung smart TV. Okay. And I'm just like,
Useful. That's useful compared to where Dex was before.
I'm glad you find it useful.
But it's still kind of something. You have to have a Samsung TV, and you have to have probably a newish Samsung TV to make this work. But before, especially when they first started talking about Dex on the phone, it was, hey, plug your phone into your monitor, and then you can plug in a keyboard and mouse, and you can have a weird, crappy desktop experience while not actually having access to your phone. It was not great.
Welcome improvement. Now on the Tab S7 Plus, when you snap on the keyboard, Dex now launches automatically because and they added support for things like multi-finger gestures on the trackpad. So now you can swipe up and down with two fingers and launch the app drawer from the homepage. You can switch between apps. Much more intuitive.
iPad gestures, by the way. Those are clearly iPad gestures.
But they're also Windows gestures. Like I'm switching from a PC to the Dex, and it was fine. I just think that I still ran into some issues. Now, I will say that the software that I'm running was not final, right? This is a hands-on preview unit. Samsung is really quick to caution that we don't draw any final impressions off of this. I'm waiting to see.
I like how Samsung's new strategy is send you things. Is like, guys, is it working? Tell us if it's working.
Let's just say this isn't a new strategy. I will say that, until this tablet launches officially, they're saying in the fall, but then in the keynote they said August 21st. I think that's when you can pre-order it. In that time, I really wish Samsung does something to make Dex better. I am already intrigued by other software, though, right? Sure. Samsung Notes, I was trying to get at with the Note 20 as well, has some major improvements, right? First of all, you can import PDFs and annotate them with the S Pen, which is really handy when you need to sign a document on the go. The other more intriguing thing is audio transcription, it looks like. You can pull in an audio recording or record audio from the app, and then as you're recording, write notes and have your notes sync to the time of when the recording is. So for example, when you play it back, you remember you jotted down a note at 3 minutes in.
That's super useful. That could be cool.
Oh my gosh, that's incredible. And it's very similar to Otter.ai and other services like that, like Google's recorder app already. But for Samsung to do it and seemingly do it better because they're allowing time save, right? I just can't wait to check that out.
We'll see. This sounds like one of those things that makes a great demo, and then once you start using it, who knows how realistic it actually is. One thing about Notes too, that Microsoft partnership goes all the way to Notes. Like that's going to sync to Outlook. Your Samsung Notes are going to sync to OneNote, and
Live Sync.
That's some useful usability stuff for PC users, when you're going back and forth from devices. Just shout out to that. What are the prices for these things, Sherlyn, and how do you think they compare to basically to the iPad Pro, which it seems like what they're fighting against.
I know that they compare actually to the iPad Pro. They're a little bit cheaper than the iPad Pro. I remember it was, it was a bit like about like $899 or $849 starting price with for the larger one, and then up around the $699 or $649 for the smaller S7. But it's that price reasonable. Does not include the keyboard.
No!
I know.
I hate this. Is
similarly to the iPad Pro, though, you kind of have to shell out
extra
for the...
I hate this so much.
But okay. Samsung does throw in the S Pen for that price. So I guess that's nice.
Whoop-dee-doo. Anyway, so new premium tablets from Samsung. We'll see how they hold up, especially. I'm looking forward to your full review. I want to play with these at some point. I wish Android tablets didn't just die. Google gave up on them, and that's why they died. So.
A lot of people gave up on them.
Yeah, I still love them. Okay, real quick, Sherlyn, because we spent so much time on these phones. Okay. Galaxy Watch 3, why should I care about it? What's new? And tell us about the Buds Live as well.
Why should you care about the Watch 3? Well, for one thing, you'll get this... I don't know why you should care. I don't think you're going to care. You're going to love the Apple Watch Series 5.
This is a tech reviewer just giving up. You threw up your hands like, I don't know why you should care about this.
Because I think the main thing with the Watch 3 is that it gets a set of improvements that seem piecemeal, but together I think make it a better health tracking device.
Sure.
The hardware is largely the same. Quick note, that name is confusing as hell. I've got people in my Twitter mentions telling me to talk about this. Yes, it is so confusing. It's the Galaxy Watch 3, but technically it's only the second Galaxy Watch, right?
Right.
And then in between, you've had the Galaxy Watch Active and the Watch Active 2.
Wasn't so there a Gear Watch 2 at one point?
But the Gear is before they renamed everything to the Galaxy Watch. So let's forget they ever existed, I guess. So we start with the Galaxy Watch, which was launched 2 years ago, then the Watch Active 2, and now we've got the Watch Active 3, which to Samsung is continuity. But to me, it's like you skip the second guy.
Listen, we went from Galaxy S10 to 20.
S20.
We went from Note. Like, numbers don't mean anything. Nothing means anything. If we've learned anything in 2020, nothing means anything. Society is a sham. Thank you, Samsung, for proving it. Okay, what else?
We're going to have to try to keep this podcast short for some reason, so you're not going to be able to hear my full thoughts on the Watch 3, so go over to the website. But they're getting a lot of new health tools, like the ECG feature that was already on the Apple Watch Series 4. Mm-hmm. There's an electrode on the side of the bezel where there's buttons. You put your finger on there for 30 seconds and you get an ECG reading, similar to how the Apple Watch works.
This was pretty much the same.
When we were briefed on this a few days before Unpacked, we were told this is awaiting FDA approval, but it's going to be available only in Korea at launch. But during the event, they were like, and we can say now that it got FDA approval. So it feels like at some point they got FDA approval and this will be available in the US in the coming months. Then
so
you've got
a new Apple Watch feature. Great.
Sure. Okay. But there's also another feature that Samsung borrowed from the Apple Watch that it didn't talk about during the keynote. Uh-huh. And it's trip detection. When I first saw that name, I was confused. I was like, when I'm going on a trip, you're going to like tell if I've left the country or something? What are you talking about? But it's actually their way of rewording Apple's fall detection. So when you've fallen down, they can't say fall detection because that's too Apple-esque. But when you've fallen down while you're in motion, okay, they will, you know, recognize that and then kind of ping you to see if you're okay. And then if you're not, they will send emergency alerts to your four contacts that you've set up in the Samsung Health app.
This, by the way, is where I feel Samsung's language tends to fail because we trip all the time. I trip on the sidewalk. I trip on the couch. I trip on all sorts of things. A fall is very different. Yeah. That is like when you go full flat on your butt or face or something like that is a serious thing where you may need help. I don't think they quite understand the difference there.
Anyhow, feature has been added. There's also a new blood pressure monitor reading, a monitoring feature that uses an algorithm to calculate your systolic and diastolic rates. And that's not going to come to the US just yet. It's first available in Korea. It's still pending FDA approval. But I'm surprised you say that's cool. To use this blood pressure monitoring service on the Watch 3, you'll first need to calibrate it with a blood pressure cuff, okay? Before you even use initiate.
Because you can't really just do it with a device. You need the cuff. Yeah.
Then every month, you're going to have to recalibrate it. So why the hell do I need the watch? I'm just going to buy the book.
They should give you the cuff with the watch or something. Anyway. I can't get over the trip detection, by the way, because I want...
You're so funny.
Will the watch just, like, every time I, like, slip a little on a carpet, is the watch going to be like, hey, you okay? Are you okay, man?
I mean, maybe. I haven't used it.
It is the Clippy of very, like, simple house trips. Like, that's it. It's like, I see you've hit your knee on the couch. Are you okay? Are you fine?
Well,
Thank you, Samsung.
They did go to lengths to explain that their trip detection will only happen while you're in motion, not while you're idle or whatever. So yeah. I don't know. I still don't know how it will work. I will be getting some time with the watch.
I just imagine tripping over my cat and Bixby being like, what happened? Are you okay? Is your cat okay?
I just realized that this means that when I'm reviewing this watch, I'm going to have to trip a few times.
I'm sorry. I'm not there to just like, throw you
trip
over.
Trip me. Yeah. Use your leg to trip me. There's a lot of other new features coming up with the Watch 3. I do want to talk about things like the new health tracking and SpO2 and VO2.
You have a hands-on already, or is that coming?
It's coming. We have a sort of light first look kind of story already on the site. You know, one of the hallmarks of the Galaxy Watch line is its spinning bezel. It's back, but it's been slimmed down and it's a little bit different. There's a different feel to it. But I'm getting notes from our producer that I need to hurry the hell up. So let's
move
on.
Don't say that on air, Sherlyn. Come on.
But I feel pressured.
Smoothly
so let's do
move
this.
To the next topic.
There are the new Galaxy Buds Live, which, like every other company on Earth, Samsung has been making true wireless earbuds happen.
By the way, they had to introduce another freaking name into their lineup because we had the Galaxy Buds. It's the Galaxy Buds Live.
I have no idea what live means here, but maybe it's because it's for life. I don't know.
They're live because they're little P-shaped things that look like suppositories. So they make you feel
alive. Wow, that's
what
you've been saying. The rest of the internet has been calling them the beans. But anyway,
the beans.
We have a review that just went up on Engadget.com by our audio guru, Billy Steele. So make sure to check that out on Engadget.com. He has some thoughts. Now, one of the things about the Galaxy Buds Live, by the way, which retail for $169, is that they promised this thing called open active noise canceling. And honestly, that's very tricky wording. Tricky wording.
An open headphone means you're actually hearing outside noise.
Yep.
It's more like how the normal AirPods work.
Yep.
But they're adding noise cancellation to that, which does not make sense. Because noise cancellation is all about having a seal from the outside world and blocking things out. So it is vinegar and water, basically, that they're mixing.
A vent on these buds that lets air and sound through. So there is no way you can have a noise seal on these things.
Sure.
And so open active noise canceling, according to a lot of people I've spoken to who have been reviewing the buds recently, a lot of people are not seeing a difference at all when you turn on this noise canceling or not.
That shouldn't work. That doesn't make any sense.
Don't expect that kind of noise canceling from these buds. If you want better battery life, and better sound quality and a good noise canceling, sort of a noise-ish seal, the Galaxy Buds Plus, I think, are still very good. They don't have actual active noise canceling, but they're pretty good at blocking out sound.
This is sort of like the difference between the Surface headphones, the Surface earbuds, right?
Yeah.
And the AirPods Pro. The AirPods Pro, actual noise canceling, they form a seal. The Surface earbuds were all about having an open thing so you can wear them all day and still hear the world around you. And I think that's what Samsung is going for. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, they want you to have them in all day. You to hear the outside world.
It's a whole different product. So that's why they made it look nicer, too. At least that's what... I mean, a lot of people think they do look nice. I know you think they look like suppositories.
Yeah.
One quick word.
Listen, beyond in-ear buds into something else buds.
Jeez.
Basically.
Dev,
yeah.
Keep it PG.
The best sound quality. The best sound quality. Bone conduction.
I will say one quick thing. The battery life on this thing is rated for about 6 hours if you have all of the different always-on features on, 8 hours of playback nonstop, and then that's still less than the Galaxy Buds Plus, which were about 10 and 12 hours. So don't expect too much of the battery life here.
I don't. And what was the pricing again?
It was about $169. So about
that is the range we're seeing. $150 to $200 is where you're going to be. We're going to have to do another headphone roundup at some point.
For the full breakdown and our review, check out Engadget.com. Billy Steele's review is already live.
Sherlyn, let's talk about the Pixel 4a. You called it the best mid-range, the best $350 smartphone.
Yes.
I agree with you. I completely agree with you, but it looks fantastic. How is it?
So my biggest thing about this is that for $350, you're getting a flagship level camera and flagship level performance. The hardware itself, in terms of the CPU, might not be flagship level, but the camera, Jesus, like it's the same sensor as on the Pixel 4.
Sure.
And because of Google's processing algorithm, it's just much better than any sub $400 camera I've seen.
Yeah.
To me, cameras, like, one of the areas that mid-range phones tend to fall short on, and to see this be so much better now, in fact, again, flagship level. Like, I played a game with Chris Velasco during my review period where I'm like, hey, bro, guess which phone took this picture, the 4 or the 4A, hey? And he only guessed it right, like, 50% of the time.
Oh, really?
So that's telling, because sometimes he was like, this is a 4A. No, this is a 4. And it's like, it's so hard to tell. These are the two main things for me, right? Camera and performance. But you also get what is Google's first true all-screen phone. This is a 5.8-inch display. It's an OLED. And actually, I'm not sure if it's an OLED. I'm almost 100%
sure. I can't
imagine
it's OLED for $350.
You know what? Let me double check.
Let's go.
You know what the funny thing is that, like, I just wrote this review not that long ago. And I can't remember because my head is full of Samsung facts right now.
We all write our reviews in fugue states. So it's like, I go back and see something I've written a year ago and have no recollection of that at all.
Review. Oh, yeah. It is an OLED. So it's a full HD plus OLED with a cutout transmissive hole, they're calling it, for the camera on the front.
That's pretty
high.
For
$350.
For $350, because compared that to the iPhone SE 2 that producer Ben has recently acquired, that is still rocking the old, like, iPhone 8 case, basically.
Ben right? asked me to shame him for getting the iPhone SE 2020 edition, and bro,
just in terms of design and looks, like, yeah, this is the better option, clearly.
Yeah. I would say that, like, the design is so much more modern thanks to this all-screen look. And we have, you know, we don't have the same hardware. I say we, like, I'm part of this team. The Pixel 4a doesn't have the same hardware in terms of a high-end processor like the iPhone SE does, right? That one's the high-end A13, I believe, chipset, which powers the likes of the 11 Pro. But, you know, software here makes all the difference. Not only does it make the OS, which is Android 10, run really fast, but it also makes the battery somehow last longer. Battery life was a huge concern for Pixel devices. The 3 was dismal. The 3 and 3 XL were bad. The 4, it's where Google started to make some improvements, and the 4 XL. The 3A was fine too. But the 4A, honestly, like, I won't say it blew me away. Like, it wasn't the longest lasting, but it beat the iPhone SE. And it generally sticks around for a day and a half easy.
It's
right?
pretty good. I want to get this for my wife, because she is, unfortunately, staunch team Android, which makes it really hard for our devices to coexist in the world. But also, this is one of the smallest Android devices out there right now, too, right? For people who want that pint-sized phone, this is a good... It's a good thing for small hands, I imagine.
Yeah. I love the size. And one of the things Google had to do to cut down production costs, which is, like, they had to minimize everything to just one variant. Mm-hmm. There's just one size. So there's only the Pixel 4a and no 4a XL. And again, like, most mid-range phones from big makers like Samsung, OnePlus, and Apple even are in one size. So that's not a huge deal.
Sure.
But there's also only one color variant. It's only in this just black, very basic looking color,
which feels sad. Yeah. People would jump. They would jump on different colors. People want to personalize these things so many ways. Most people will probably put a case on it too, so you can always do that.
Exactly. Yeah. So the
give me OLED rather than multiple colors. I'll take that trade off any day.
That's what I think. I think that Google trimmed the right fat here. I think that Google was able to, you know, determine what's important to people and then give us what matters. So what matters to me, even though the battery size technically is a little bit small, it's 3140 milliamp hours, but they've worked hard to make that last a little longer. Now, caveat here that I think over time this number will fall. I think that battery performance will deteriorate, but every phone deteriorates over time, so that's par for the course. What else about this guy? I mean, one thing that concerns me is that it doesn't actually have water resistance rated. I have had this thing fall like two or three times now because I'm very careless.
That's the red flag because unfortunately, one of the phones I bought my wife at one point, she left outside in the rain. Like things, especially if you have a baby around, like things happen. Phones get wet. And I feel like the basics of water resistance is a thing we should have in all of our devices. Yep. So that's sad.
Okay. I will say the water resistance is like an issue for me, but the durability is not bad at all. Again, like I said, like this thing has fallen on its face, on its back a couple of times and not a scratch. Whereas the OnePlus Nord has already got deep scratches on its face. And Matt Smith, our reviewer for the OnePlus Nord, didn't even drop it. So,
yeah. By the way, that is my experience with every single OnePlus device. As great as they look, like you put that in your pocket, in a jeans pocket for a week, it will come out somehow. The screen is cracked. Somehow, like an edge is like has a big, you know, gash on it. So,
yeah.
That is what you give up with OnePlus, unfortunately. I know it has its fans, but yeah.
It's a nicer build and everything, and it's got nice colors, and it's got more cameras on the back, but it's also not available in the US, and it costs $50 more. Again, not a big deal, but still something that some people will be concerned about in terms of build. Another thing that I wanted to shout out on the Pixel 4a, the fingerprint sensor, y'all. I mean, I love it. I maintain that, like, fingerprint sensors still need to be around for a while. Whether you move it to under the display or you move it to, I don't know, somewhere else, I think, especially given we're all wearing masks now and will be for a while, fingerprint sensor is just very important. It's good to have options. And then there's also the headphone jack, which one of our listeners, one of our listeners emailed us a while ago saying that he's very concerned that they're going away forever. They are going away, but you'll still have one new phone to buy before it fully goes away.
This is pretty great.
That should be this phone.
I'm really digging it. I wanna get my hands on it too. I miss it used to be, I feel like we were really working hard to get phones down cheaper and more accessible. And then Google shifted, like they made the Pixel line a little more expensive, you know, than where things were on the Nexus line. And then phones started going beyond $1,000. And I feel like we went into crazy town. Give me cheaper phones. The hardware can be cheap. It can be affordable and more accessible to people. Like, that's what I want.
Yeah, I think there is something to be said about trying very hard to make a good phone with what you're given and what you've got. And Google is trying to do that with the Pixel 4a. And we have an article from Chris Velasco, because we did an interview with Google's lead product managers on this thing, about how it was able to get the device so cheap. Because they set themselves, what they told us was they set themselves a target to make this the best phone they could for $400. And then Google's like engineers went about and did such a great job that they were able to just be like, hey, we can actually make this for $350. So let's
That's
do
amazing.
It.
Sure.
That's, to me, incredible. And a lot of it is software. Now, speaking of software, I also, there's a lot of things to shout out about this thing. One of the things that blew me away about the Pixel 4a is the software. I love the Pixel UI. There's a lot of features there that help Google set its Pixel series apart from other Android phones. So you've got things like, you know, you already had things like call screening and the new assistant, which is available on the 4a. But with the 4a, they introduced live caption for calls. To me, this is huge. To me, I firmly believe any accessibility tool we can include in our devices that will really help people is important. We have to have it in every phone.
Sure.
Live caption was already on older Pixel phones. Now it's getting rolled out for calls. So, you know, one of the issues they, you know, with why they couldn't add it to phones before was that it would come up with captions for people talking to you on the phone, and that would be able to be screenshotted. So that's kind of dicey. There's issues of consent. There's issues of letting the person know they're being recorded or something like that. So Google's found a workaround. Whenever you have your live caption for calls on a call, which, by the way, works on cellular, voice apps, video apps, whatever it is, Google will first alert the person you're talking to that you're using live caption for calls and that what they say will show up on your screen.
Okay.
And then, you know, take over. So the transcription wasn't completely accurate. It's just if you've used Recorder app, if you've used any of Google's voice to speech features or voice to text features, you'll know that it's about 95%
accurate.
That's
cool. Does this do any translation yet? Because I know that's
I know.
Thing.
I know. Yeah. That was one of the things I asked them too, and it's not yet.
Microsoft is doing that. Like Microsoft, I love this voice tech, and I love that Microsoft and Google are kind of like pushing each other to see who's doing best. Microsoft brought in live transcriptions of Skype, I believe, and more translation tech. I don't know like how well that works. I haven't been able to test it, but I do know that they've been exploring it. This is the future of our tech. You know, like when we can travel again, I want to have. Yeah. I can't wait until I can have like live subtitles too, like when I go somewhere over my augmented reality glasses. Yes, please. This is where we're going.
That's the world we're headed towards. I do think that I make a big deal of live caption and live caption for calls as being an important accessibility feature, and it is for people who are hard of hearing and deaf. But it's also useful for just everyone. If you're on an airplane and the jet engine noise is just too loud, and you just want to hear what's going on in this video, and it works for videos that you've had on your phone, not even streaming on YouTube or whatever, it will work. It'll show you as a backup for what you need to hear or see. It works in subway stations, noisy cafes, wherever you don't want to have the audio out or you can't hear the audio, you need live captions. It just is useful. So I think this is thoughtful on the part of Google and companies like Microsoft as well. I want to see more of this.
Yeah, and great phone overall. A nice return to form for Google, basically.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's just, for the price, there's no better phone. Sorry, Ben, who just got the iPhone SE 2020.
Sorry, everybody who got the iPhone SE 2. Technically a faster processor, but it's a phone. Like, I don't know how much you're really gonna push that hardware, Like, the camera matters more, the form factor matters more.
I would love to eventually hear from Ben how much battery life he's getting out of the iPhone SE on a daily basis, because it doesn't sound like it sounded like it was doing half of what the Pixel 4a is
Oh boy. Okay.
Let's see. Yeah.
Speaking of Apple, and speaking of the iPhone, there was a bit of an Apple refresh this week, which really felt like they're doing the anime thing. They're doing Notice Me Senpai. I have hardware too. That is a last-minute refresh of the 27-inch iMac, and also the 21.5-inch iMac is getting some updates too. Nothing super exciting. The design is the same as before. The cool thing is they finally have the 10th-gen Intel chips, and I feel like that's a significant thing. This may be the final big Intel refresh before they start moving to ARM next year. I don't think that's happening. That feels like... It's like the equivalent of like Babe Ruth like pointing to to out and like saying I'm gonna swing the ball that hard. I don't think they're gonna have those chips ready to power something like an iMac by next year. Maybe they'll surprise us. First of all, it's weird that they even told us that was happening and would be coming. I don't know. But anyway, these sound like good iMacs, good updates overall. 10th gen Intel chips, SSDs. Are standard. It is 2020, and it took Apple until 2020 to make SSDs standard on their like very popular all-in-one PCs. I'm a bit shocked by that, because by now we're into like the second generation of SSDs. We're now into like talking about the faster NVMe SSDs that give you like near PCIe speeds. Like, they're faster than the old SSDs that were like shaped like laptop hard drives. We're at that point now, and Apple is like, hey, okay, yeah, I guess let's make them standard. Anyway, nice.
I think our editor-in-chief Dana Woolman was working on coverage, and she brought up the fact that this has a 1080p webcam.
Amazing. Hey, well, you know what's crazy? All of Apple's machines, even the excellent MacBook Pro 16-inch that I love, that thing, expensive computers, amazing computers, 720p webcams. It's like Apple was just stuck with that sensor, and they just never wanted to move on. Finally they have 1080p in one of their built-in webcams in 2020.
Yeah.
It took you long enough, Apple.
A lot of laptops don't have good webcams anyway, so
most laptops don't have good webcams, but I feel like all-in-ones try a little harder usually. Yeah. And certainly if I buy a MacBook Pro, I'm expecting something better than, a typical crappy PC webcam. True. But anyway, we've seen some footage too from Dana on this webcam, and it looks good.
It
looks like a great standalone webcam, which is exactly what you'd want these days. So these are exciting. You've got Radeon Pro 5300 graphics, 5500 XT. Like, you can get decent graphics in there. Those are some of the new like AMD RDNA cards. So decent performance for, you know, video for video work and computation work. You're not really going to be playing games on Macs, unfortunately. Like, Apple's just never been into that. But hey, new iMacs, they're cool. They're better for people who just really, really cannot live without an iMac. So we'll see what next year brings. I feel like that's the big one. In some big news this week, the Trump administration is really trying to, put its thumb on the scales of tech. We learned, just as we were starting to record this morning, the Trump administration started talking about extra restrictions they want to place on Chinese companies, effectively creating a technology wall against Chinese companies. And that means like getting them to remove their apps from U.S. Devices and U.S. stores, and also blocking China from having access to apps in the U.S. This seems like complete make-believe, but this is not surprising given like the sort of like, I don't know, political wall-building philosophy they've really been going with. What do you think, Sherlyn? Does this seem feasible or anything?
First of all, I don't like the wall analogy.
The wall.
Like, just stop it. Like,
we're building, like, Trump wants to build his own great firewall.
Stop it with your walls, okay? But anyway, I think it's pretty ridiculous to expect that you can completely cut off a country as big as China from, you know, accessing your country in terms of its technology, services, and devices. Like, you're basically saying that, no, we don't want any of your stuff. We don't see any of your stuff being potentially useful to us ever at all. And that's completely untrue.
Given the state of the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Chinese products are in this country already. If you're going to have this weird fear about everything that's made in China, mm-hmm. then like, I'm sorry, but your entire house might need to be taken apart.
All your devices are being manufactured in China, most likely. So what are you going to do?
The article that went up today, based off of the NPR interview, talks about how, you know, there's, and I want to pull up the correct quote here so that I'm not misquoting anyone. The article is... It was infuriating for me to read. It's
well, and this, by the way, was a radio piece, so this is the written transcription. Let me just say, I woke up this morning, I was brushing my teeth, and then just hearing, I was like, okay, I heard the headline, Trump administration wants to block more Chinese companies, and then they just go into it, and it's just like trying not to choke on my toothpaste while I roll my eyes at how stupid this all is. Like, that's what I was doing this morning.
So it doesn't sound like, the host Sabri Benishar was speaking with Marketplace's Scott Tong, who just also knows what's going on. He's not involved with the administration, doesn't seem like, though. So he was saying that the rationale, Scott Tong said, the rationale is that the U.S. needs clean networks, in quotes, to guard Americans' data and the secrets of U.S. companies. So the plan might be to remove untrusted Chinese apps from Apple and Google App Stores, including TikTok and WeChat, to stop American apps from installing on Chinese brand phones, to limit these Chinese cloud service companies from accessing data here, and to protect data on undersea cables from China.
Undersea cables. Which, by the way, Google is going to be launching a new undersea cable soon. So that is a thing. That is an important bit of connectivity. But this seems insane.
Then my favorite part is where Tong is also asked in this NPR interview, what's the evidence that these Chinese tech firms are harmful? And Tong goes, we're still waiting for that in many cases. With Huawei, the government has yet to produce a smoking gun. Same with TikTok. Surely there's evidence of hacking into networks. All countries, including including China and the U.S., do that.
Yes. By the way, that is true. Like, every major country has, like, a frenemy relationship with each other. And a lot of it's
Russia?
Just like, I'm hacking your network. And then your security people go, like, we see you. And then they wink. And then you hack them, and it goes back and forth. And that's a whole other topic, and that's like a deeper thing. But that is, I don't know, casual espionage, I'd say. This whole thing is crazy. And let's bring up TikTok, too, because what happened since in the last week of news, we heard, after months of basically saying he wanted to ban TikTok, Trump said last week that, oh yeah, they want to shut down TikTok entirely. Then on Friday and Saturday, we start to hear more news like, oh, maybe Microsoft could be the one to kind of take it over. If ByteDance sold U.S. operations of TikTok, like, it could still continue running in this country. And Microsoft came out of nowhere. It's like they were hiding behind a curtain, just ready to snap this up. We started hearing that Microsoft would be into it. Then Sunday night, around 8 p.m., I saw an update on my Twitter that Microsoft confirmed in a letter that it was working in together talks, with the Trump administration. Right. Satya Nadella has talked with Trump to take over TikTok, and they're still trying to figure out a deal with ByteDance. So they're in discussions, but they're aiming to close discussions by September 15th. And that means they will either buy TikTok or just fail and somebody else could do it too. This is where we're at right now. And this is wild that so much has changed in the past week. What's
while,
up?
What while do you think, Jillian? Yeah, there's so much to talk about this. Two real quick things from the land of Twitter. One, as the Microsoft potential acquisition rumors were flying around, people were like, oh, what other companies might be interested? Snapchat might have been interested, it seemed. But then I like how Apple came out and was just like, no. Straight up, yo, we're not interested. No interest, guys. That was great. Yeah. And then
we've
the other
tried
thing
social
was...
networks, not our thing. Yeah.
Good. They know what they're good at. Great. Yeah. The other thing is people around Twitter obviously immediately were like, yo, I want to check out your LinkedIn on TikTok. Like, just that very unholy matrimony of LinkedIn and TikTok. And then all these Steve Ballmer videos are coming up, and they were like, Steve Ballmer would have been perfect for TikTok.
Data. But just really, so real quick, takes. Let's just say, I feel like that is the ultimate thing. We have no idea what Microsoft is going to be doing.
No.
It's not just the US. They'll be taking over TikTok, I believe, in Canada and New Zealand and a couple other countries too. It is really the data and what TikTok unearths for Microsoft, especially from a younger audience, that could be really powerful as it helps Microsoft like try to figure out new products and how maybe by learning these TikTok memes, you will learn features you want to put into like Windows, the movie editor or something, like things people will actually want to use. Right. So that's the data we're really looking at. Who knows where all this is going? Let's move on to what we're actually working on too. Sherlyn, this entire episode has been what you're working on. Is there anything else you want to shout out?
I mean, yeah, I just got in the Galaxy Watch 3 and the Note 20 Ultra. There is no deadline really on some of these things. So you can keep watching me drip feed information. I will definitely be talking about it on our site and my social media, but still more that I can't talk about either. So
there's more, so much more. And yeah, we're expecting a lot of different news next week too. So yeah, I'm gearing up. Next week sounds busy. A lot of stuff we can't talk about yet, but sounds like it's going to be news heavy. And I also just wrote up Disney's earnings this past week, where they announced that the live action version of Mulan, which has been delayed for a while, is actually coming to Disney Plus on September 4th for an additional $30.
Jesus.
And I feel like that kind of broke my brain a little, and it broke like entertainment journalism, because we were like, wait, what? You've never talked about having additional like products for sale within Disney Plus. And to clarify, yes, you will need a Disney Plus subscription to buy this
and
thing.
$30.
So that's $7 a month plus or the $70 annual plan. And Disney confirmed to us that this is not a rental. You'll be able to have access to the movie, I think, maybe until it actually becomes a part of the Disney Plus library.
Well,
so that's
they said
like another
like,
3 or 4 months. Yeah.
As long
but
as
you have
you
access
have a...
as long as you have a Disney Plus subscription, which to me seems, bleep me, effed. But that's basically, that's what it is. That's insane. You would never need a subscription to watch something on iTunes or Vudu. So I wrote a piece about this, basically saying Disney has no clue what they're doing with Mulan. And I think that is the case. I think like there's a lot going on that's up in the air here. They're kind of experimenting. But it is wild to me that Disney never officially announced this. There's no tweet. There's no like written evidence of them saying they're going to do this. It was Bob Chapek on the earnings call just saying, hey, Mulan, September 4th. What do you think about that, everybody? There's no press release. There's no like actual documentation for any of this.
Maybe and they're leaving room for them to change their minds.
Oh, no, they're definitely leaving room for like, oh, we're just going to not do this or like change history. Or if it fails, and I don't think it's going to fail. But if they fail, they could be like, well, hey, did we really try that? You know, it's all weird. But go check out my piece. It's very ranty because I just think Disney's kind of making this up as they go along. I feel like that's dangerous and they haven't fully thought this through. It is a good deal for families. $30 for a new movie. You know, for a family, that is a lot cheaper than going to the theater and buying snacks and bringing the kids and managing the kids and everything.
That's true. That's
so I think on a broader level, it is good, but they need to deal with the access problem. And I think they need to link up with Movies Anywhere, which is, I think that's a property they're like directly in control of at this point. If you bought it on Disney Plus, linked it to Movies Anywhere, and then like, okay, afterwards could view it on iTunes or Vudu or something after if you quit Disney Plus, That's fair. That seems fine to me. But right now, it seems like they have no plan. They're like a chicken running around headless. It's insane right now. So keep an eye out for more details on that. So let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. So much tech. I feel like, oh man, this is why movies and TV are such a break for me. So I want to talk about I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which I know you've recommended already, Sherlyn. It's on HBO. But this is the, docuseries based on Michelle McNamara's book about hunting for the Golden State Killer, basically. First of all, it is one of the darkest and craziest things I've seen in some time. It is genuinely scary she goes into how she's basically followed a serial rapist and murderer, followed the evidence, tried to figure out who he was. And she is somebody who's really into true crime. I think it's a really well-made documentary, and she sadly passed away a couple of years ago. Her book came out, posthumously, and they found the Golden Gate killer, right? So based on a lot of her work. So the show itself is good. It is terrifying. It is very disturbing, but I think it is worth watching just to see how somebody can explore the dark side of humanity. And on a brighter note, I want to bring up Black is King, which is on Disney Plus. And this is Beyonce's visual concept album that's sort of it is her live action interpretation of The Lion King, basically.
Amazing.
And it's beautiful. The soundtrack is excellent. It's based on the album, I think it's called The Gift, the album that came out alongside the live action Lion King, or the CG animated Lion King that she was a part of. Her kind of retelling the story, based also on African myth and African religion and culture and things like that too. So it's a visually lush, beautiful, incredible sounding piece of art, and she's credited with directing it too, along with some visual artists. There's some amazing work here, so it's a great thing to just turn on, let yourself get swept up by it. It's not the sort of thing, to me it's like an experimental art piece. Do not worry about narrative. Not worry about pieces connecting together. Go for the ride, enjoy the journey, enjoy the visuals. I think it's fantastic, and that's on Disney Plus right now. You don't have to pay an extra $30 to see that. It's just there. So enjoy it. And Sherlyn, what's up with you?
Yeah, Twitter was abuzz with Black is King. Now, I saved my recommendation to hide from Devendra, as always.
Is now your thing. You just want to surprise me with these recs every time. So go for it.
I have three things, one main thing and two quick shout outs. I saw Fast Color on Hulu for the first time.
So good.
It's so good. Very enjoyable. So good. Very, very Homecoming-esque in its storytelling, but very nice superhero type show, but very low key.
It's a low budget superhero movie about motherhood, and I love it.
Yeah. Beautiful, well acted, well performed, beautiful work. And the special effects were great. The other one I wanted to shout out was, everybody's seen this already, The Umbrella Academy season 2 was nice. I enjoyed it. I saw all this during the weekend when I had time to take a quick break from all of this work that I was killing myself over. But Umbrella Academy, nice development for all the characters. If you enjoy the first season, you enjoy the second one. Now, my main recommendation is something I'm pretty sure Devendra and you, dear listener, have not heard of. It is this series called Invisible Stories on HBO. Devendra, have you heard of it?
I've heard of it, yeah.
So this is near and dear to my heart. It's from a Singaporean filmmaker, and it's about some people living in a housing estate in Singapore. It's 6 short stories that aren't really that connected, so it's more like an anthology series, but each story features a different person from the housing estate in Singapore. And the title kind of tells it all, right? Invisible Stories. Now, you might know Singapore for how it's responded to COVID-19. You might know Singapore for the ridiculous fines we pay for things like littering. Or you might know Singapore from Crazy Rich Asians. But this this Singapore in Invisible Stories is the Singapore no one gets to see. Or even in Singapore, it is sanitized. The government really doesn't like people seeing this side of Singapore. It is stories of people struggling with mental health, which is so stigmatized in Singapore. It is stories of sex workers in Singapore who are immigrants who are trying to make a living in Singapore so they can send their money home to their other family in other parts of Asia. And these are, for me, I was very privileged growing up in Singapore. I didn't see a lot of this, what the filmmaker calls the underbelly of Singapore. I didn't see a lot of this growing up because, again, I was very privileged. I had friends and, acquaintances who lived in these situations, but just not me. And like, I was so lucky to just not be able to have seen a lot of that growing up, but watching this show, the other thing I like about it is it's so authentic. It's mm-hmm. really a Singapore show. You'll hear that we don't all speak in English all the time. There are no British accents. Crazy Rich Asians was ridiculous because we're like, well, where are all these accents coming from? This is real. And I can speak in my real Singaporean accent after this quickly, but mm-hmm. It's also a mix of languages like Hokkien, Chinese, Malay. We all speak all these different languages as a hodgepodge. This is our national culture. I've never seen a truer representation of Singapore done like this. So really, if you're interested, not even just to get to know Singapore better as see another dimension to it, but these stories of these people living their lives, trying their best to just kind of make it through life, I think that's like worth watching this series for. It's Invisible Stories on HBO Max.
That's cool. I'm looking forward to checking this out too.
Tell me what you think. I would love to hear what you think because I think it's been really well done. The second episode of the series, by the way, is slightly spooky, which we love. Singaporeans sure. love horror, but you know, if you're not, that's not your thing, skip the second episode. And that's it for our episode today, everyone. Thank you as always for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, and I chat about movies and TV at the /filmcast at /film.com.
If you want to engage me all about the secrets of Singapore and all of the Singaporean stories that you have, you can hit me up on Twitter at Sherlyn Lowe. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. Singaporean accent, okay. Usually when I go to Taiwan, right, I will go to Singapore afterwards. So I will see my family. I will see, you know, I'll go back to Singapore and eat a lot of food. And like, I usually get very fat. And in Singapore, like, I'm very fat, actually, honestly. And then like, whenever I go back to Singapore, I'll also find some like new restaurants because there's this thing called this pom pom porridge, and it's so delicious. My parents took me to eat, I think it was in Yishun or something, and I'm getting messages from our video production crew that I sound like a totally different person, and y'all need a whole new like way of identifying who I am.